groups moving along. That is local and regional trade that followed along the same routes. The cities in the Tarim Basin have produced documents of the 4th century, a series of letters that were found by Stein's group excavating near Dongguan that apparently talks about some of these lesser trade routes. So there's constant movement of goods, both the long-distance, high-prestige items, lesser regional and local trade moving along the same routes, and very often merchants were dealing in one commodity and they carried along what is called a tag good, that is a lesser item that you pick up along the way, you know, kind of a conversation piece that, well, what is it? We don't know, but we can know, we can sell it in, you know, we pick it up in Turfan. We're really dealing mainly in Chinese silks. These are some interesting Buddhist manuscripts. We can sell them at a profit once we get to Samarkand. I mean, there's a lot of this type of trading going on along the Silk Road. And so you have to envision this as a route that's in constant trade and commerce moving along there. So this is the way of transporting goods. These are the types of goods that are being moved, high prestige goods. And what's important to note is that every major participant had something of great prestige and value to swap. The Romans had grape wine. They had certain types of aromatics, spices, finished products, purple dye. The Chinese had the silks. The Sogdians actually were growing their own grape wine. They had carpets and linens. So all sorts of prestige goods are being moved along by all of the participants in the Silk Road. How do you move these goods? How do you get them from place A, point A to point B? Especially in a world that doesn't have modern banking instruments and certainly doesn't have all the advantages of high technology. Well, the way goods were traditionally moved in all trade concerns from the earliest trade records we have from the Middle East, those would be the Sumerian merchants of, say, 3500 to 3000 BC, really down to the modern age, was through networks of families and almost family guilds. That meant certain types of families speaking very specific languages did much of the carrying trade. Let's move to the western arm of the Silk Road, which I know the best, and I've done quite a bit of study with in tandem with the Roman Empire. Most of the people moving goods on the overland route spoke Aramaic. This was a Semitic language widely used in the Fertile Crescent in the Near East, later displaced by Arabic. It is the language that Jesus would have preached in. It is the second lingua franca of the Eastern Roman Empire. The first is Greek, which is a very privileged literary administrative language. Aramaic-speaking merchants from cities such as Bostra or Palmyra had kinsmen in all the key cities, at Karax, the port on the Persian Gulf, in Ecbatana or Hamadan, in Merv,
Margayane,
which is today in Afghanistan. Along there, you had family, consortiums, and friends. When you set out from Palmyra, you knew that you could stop in these key sites, these cities, and there you would have friends, probably kinsmen, who could provide credit, who could stand surety with the local authorities, tell you what to need, what you need to do, provide translations, tell you what the market prices were, tell you where to sell, and how to buy. They could also extend credit, as well as redeem all sorts of letters of credit that you were carrying from home. Once you got to Merv, it was taken over by Sogdians. Sogdians were people who spoke an Eastern Iranian language. It is related to Persian. They are located in Marakanda, the future Samarkand. It's spoken in Kashgar. It is widely known all through the Tarim Basin, all the way to the Chinese capitals. The documents discovered by Sir Oral Stein indicates that Sogdian merchants had the same kind of networks linking essentially Chang'an and Luoyang, the Han, the Chinese capitals, through Dongguan, the cities of the Tarim Basin, all the way back home to essentially Samarkand, ancient Samarkand, used its ancient name, Marakanda. They took care of the same moving of goods. For the sea networks, it would be Greek, would be the language of this time. We got some remarkable documents of these Sognian merchants that were found by Stein. One of them is a report where one merchant is very, very concerned. He's in the city of Dongguan, and he's heard that the Chinese capital has been sacked in 313. That is verified by the Chinese annals. And he's not sure if the prophets would come in. He hasn't heard anything from the family concerned in that city for 3 years. Another one is a very moving letter about a woman and her daughter who are left penniless and is complaining that her husband has abandoned her and she's stuck there and she can't get enough money to pay her passage back to Samarkand. And these letters cast a glimpse at some of the kinds of conditions that went on the Silk Road. And you have to keep remembering there's a constant movement of people across that route with different conditions, different situations. These trade routes were made possible for two reasons. First, from the 2nd century BC to the 2nd century AD, based on the lectures we have given so far, we have four great imperial orders that have imposed peace over most of this route. That is the Han Empire of China, the great Kushan Empire that extends from the southern cities of the Tarim Basin across Transoxiana into northern India, the Parthian Empire, and the Roman Empire. In addition, there are powerful tribal confederacies such as the Xuannu and other nomadic peoples who appreciate and benefit from the profits of trade, hire themselves out as guards, guides, suppliers of all sorts of commodities to sustain the caravan route, and everyone profits from it. The emperors of China profited immensely. The whole production and regulation of silk, we will see the development of the silk industry, especially in the Tang and Sung period, is in response to this overseas market. Some would argue the building of the Great Canal System to link the Yellow River to the Yangtze or the Yangtze River was in part to move silk up to the northern capitals and then to export. There's also other reasons, that is, you need to feed the northern capitals with rice, but there's a number of reasons for that going on. It influences Chinese foreign policy from the reign of Wu Di on, that is, the Chinese effort to control the great corridors leading all the way to Kashgar. Another important commodity traded along the Silk Road was the great spices and aromatics from India. These would make their way to China as well as to the Roman world, and they were part of that network. Roman goods, Roman glassware, remarkably, shipped overseas as well as overland, grape wine, aromatics, all of this stuff crossed the Silk Road. And for this trade network to remain in place, some kind of sense of value had to be exported from one end to the other end. And the peoples of the steppes profited immensely in the sale of horses to the Chinese and to the various empires, to the sale of all sorts of leather goods and products. So all of the participants had a reason to maintain and extend this Silk Road, which was so important in the economic development, not only of the civilized, literate, or urban civilizations, but also of the nomadic pastoral populations across the Eurasian steppes. And so the 2nd century BC to the 2nd century AD is really a period of remarkable prosperity in intellectual and cultural exchange. Finally, one commodity that's often forgotten in this exchange is people. And it's important to stress that the ease of travel along the Silk Road made possible by these conditions, the improved travel conditions with camels, the security, the whole set of trade networks set up by merchants, that allowed for different types of individuals who were not merchants necessarily to pass over the Silk Road, but also all sorts of people were part of that trade network. Well, what do we mean by that? The great courts constantly sent missions between each other. Think of, for instance, reports of the Emperor Augustus in Rome. It's told to us that on the sea routes, he received musicians, various types of people from the Raj of Taprobane, which is today Sri Lanka, including an extraordinary man who had no arms but could play a lyre with his toes. At the Tang court, this is a bit later, from the 8th century AD, Xuanzong, one of the great emperors of the 7th century and his favorite mistress, a rather notorious lady, and favorite consort, Yang Guifei, they enjoyed all sorts of acrobatics and dancers. They made a concerted effort to attract dancers and entertainers from Central Asia, which generally shocked many members of the Confucian court. Eventually, they have to be banned. Craftsmen were another group of men who traveled over the Silk Road. And this is a tradition that lasts through the entire period. We have extremely good reports from the Mongol period, particularly from papal envoy to the court of the great Khan Güyük. His name is Giovanni Carpini. We'll be talking about him later. He traveled to the great Mongol court at Karakoram, which is today in Mongolia, and he notes the numerous craftsmen, merchants from all over the world who had come to do business at the Mongol court because of the conditions on the Silk Road. It was ideal. You had markets, you had demand, you had security, you had some order, you had the predictability of that would allow profits to proceed and therefore trade could go forth. Above all, we'll find in later medieval periods, slaves were one of the most important commodities. And in the Islamic period, remarkably, the most important slaves would be men destined to be soldiers in Islamic armies. These would usually be Turks, young men between the ages of 13 and 16 who would be captured, who would be sold into slavery, converted to Islam, and drilled to be the bodyguard or the elite forces of Turkish rulers. They're often known by a variety of names. One of the most common names is Mamluk, and that is a peculiar tradition of medieval Islam. So all of these commodities passed along the Silk Road in great numbers. But perhaps the most important people traveling on the road for the wider cultural ramifications of the civilizations of Eurasia were missionaries, monks, and merchants who had embraced new faiths, such as Christianity, Manichaeism, and above all, Buddhism. Because the Silk Road brought to the peoples of the steppes these religions, and with them writing, and a wider view of their own world, of its geography, of its political ramifications, new views of the religious reality, and the impact of these religions on the peoples of the steppes would be profound. It would lead to the organization of more effective states on the steppes, and it would draw the peoples of the steppes ever more into closer relationships with the literate urban civilizations.
Lecture 10, Buddhism, Manichaeism, and Christianity.
In this lecture, I want to continue discussing the importance of the Silk Road. We've discussed the various commodities exchanged along the Silk Road, but this lecture is going to concentrate on the exchange of ideas and, above all, religions. Perhaps the most important item that was transmitted along the Silk Road to nomadic peoples were various religions, especially Buddhism, but there are others, Nestorian Christianity, Manichaeism, Zoroastrianism, also even Judaism later on is exchanged along the Silk Road. And there are a number of reasons why these religions were appealing, not only to the caravan cities, but to the nomadic peoples who were very much caught up in the whole process of moving goods across the Silk Road. And these reasons were connected with, in part, what those religions represented, especially to the nomadic peoples. They presented a new world vision. It generally involved the adaptation of writing, a concept that was largely unknown to many of the nomadic peoples. And we will see that it will be missionaries, monks, even merchant princes of these religions who would engage in debate, who bring the art of writing to the nomadic peoples and give us the opportunity to hear the voices of some of these people later on in the early Middle Ages, particularly of Turkish speakers. Well, first and foremost, among the religions was Buddhism. It was clearly the most successful of the religions between the 4th and 8th century AD. And there were a number of reasons why Buddhism would have been appealing to people along the Silk Road. For one, the vision of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who lived in the 6th and early 5th century BC, these teachings had been reinterpreted for a wider appeal. Now, there is very little that is clear about the life of the Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama was supposedly a prince. He was born on the border between what is now Nepal and northern India. There are a number of stories of why he was moved to seek his enlightenment, which came at age 35, and eventually preached in the Deer Park at Sarnath to his followers. Basically, what troubled the Buddha was the question of suffering. And he devised a very simple system known as the Four Noble Truths on how to handle that suffering was universal within the human experience. And that involved detaching oneself from the material world and all sorts of connections and pursuing what he would call a middle way. Not the extreme asceticism practiced by some of the Jains and even some of the Hindu fakers, and not a full indulgence, protection from the ugliness of life, which had characterized Siddhartha's early life according to the legendary histories. In addition, Buddhism also represented a reaction to the caste structure, to the sacrifices administered by the Brahmins. Siddhartha Gautama himself was of the Kshatriya caste, that is the warrior caste who produced the princes and kings of northern India, who go back to the early Rig Vedas as the highest of the twice-born castes. The Brahmins were supposed to be second, but in the time of the Buddha, already the Brahmins were beginning to assert themselves as the top caste, and that is what is recognized today in Hindu India. Then below them was a merchant class, and then the so-called Sudras, and finally those with no caste. And caste, or varna, was a way of defining one's position in society as well as his relationship or her relationship in the cycle of life. Buddhism represented a rejection of this. All people who embraced the enlightenment and the teachings of the Buddha were able to achieve moksha, liberation, breaking from the eternal cycle of life, and then achieving a type of nirvana, a extinction of one's individual soul into the greater soul of the universe. Now, these teachings, as they have come down to us, and you have to remember that the original Sanskrit texts do not survive. The lives of the Buddha that have been reported, these hagiographical texts, are much later in time. And most of what we know about the early Buddhist texts are actually in translations, not in the Sanskrit that might have been used in the 6th and 5th century B.C., although the suspicion is Siddhartha probably spoke in Prakrit, that is the vernacular at the time. From the start, there were divisions as to what was the meaning of the Buddha's message. How broad-ranging was it? What was the role of monks who had achieved enlightenment? What was the relationship between the monastic community, the Sangha, and the laity who supported that monastic community, that is, those who were concentrating on enlightenment to break from the cycle of life and who would live in what we would call proto-monasteries. Vihara is eventually what they would come to be called. There were several Buddhist councils held, the first one around 400 BC and two others following. The third one was particularly important in 247 BC. And these councils, the third one was actually held under the auspices of the Mauryan Emperor Ashoka, who had come to embrace Buddhism, and he was the emperor of the first great Indian Empire, and these councils led to a division within the Buddhist community. The terms keep changing as to what the various groups are, but today they would essentially be represented by the Theravada school of Buddhism, extremely common, for instance, in Thailand and Sri Lanka, and the Mahayana vehicle. They were often called vehicles, the greater vehicle of Buddhism. And these divisions really came down to a question of what were the original teachings? Should they be translated into the vernacular? And the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, the greater vehicle tradition, essentially stressed the message over the language. That is, translation was acceptable because content was all important, not necessarily adhering to the original Sanskrit words, if that indeed was the language that was used. Another important point that comes out of that is that anyone who embraces the teachings of the Buddha, even at the lowest levels, could achieve some level of enlightenment. That was his dharma, the law of social and religious inevitability, if you will, the cycle of one's life, a notion that is shared by Hindus, Buddhists, and Jains, the law of dharma, which dictates the way you're to live, the way you are to achieve enlightenment. Well, enlightenment was achieved at different levels. And the notion in the greater vehicle was that all individuals could achieve some kind of understanding and potentially become Buddhas themselves. And that there was a whole history of Buddhas, bodhisattvas, if you will, enlightened ones who preceded the historical Buddha and will follow afterwards. And this vision, this greater vehicle vision, this Mahayana vision, is the vision that really gets exported along the Silk Road. And the reasons for it is it was extremely appealing to merchants, particularly members of the merchant caste in Hindu India, who were only at the third level in the strict caste system that had pervaded across India since, at least since the early Iron Age, when the Indo-Aryans had settled on the Gangic Indus plains. It was also very appealing to rulers who were not Indian in origin, such as the Kushan emperors, who came to rule northern India in the first and second centuries AD. I mentioned in a previous lecture that the Kushan emperor, Kanishka I, usually dated between 127 and 147 AD, was revered as a convert. He is credited with holding a fourth Buddhist council in order to reconcile the differences. But even if he didn't convert, he clearly promoted Buddhism and Buddhist monks who were operating along the Silk Road. Now, there are various reasons for this. There's two forces at work disseminating Buddhism along the Silk Road. First, the prophets of trade, the Vaishya caste in India, the merchant caste in Hindu India. Many of them came to embrace Buddhism because it was their dharma to conduct trade and to prosper. And prosperity was actually a manifestation of their dharma and gave them what is called karma, which is good value that will lead to a better life in the next reincarnation. And those notions were carefully, were strongly ingrained in greater vehicle teachings of Buddhism. And merchants very often acted as unofficial missionaries along the routes in the caravan cities among the nomadic tribes with whom they came into contact, because very often they hired the tribesmen as guards. Your other option was to fight them off as brigands. Furthermore, merchants made enormous amount of money. They built palatial homes, often held debates, collected texts. In addition, the monks who began to travel along the Silk Road, particularly under the Kushan emperors and later, translated the Buddhist texts into languages that were readily used along the Silk Road. Above all, the vernaculars that had come out of Sanskrit, such as Prakrit and later Pali. They would also translate into Tocharian, the language of the Tarim Basin, and probably the language of the Kushan emperors themselves. Eventually, texts would be translated into Turkic languages and dialects, into other Iranian dialects, and so notably Sogdian. And so the Buddhist texts were then disseminated across Transoxiana in Central Asia in a variety of languages that were readily understood by the literate classes who engage in trade. And this made the message particularly appealing. The monks themselves settled in these monasteries. Vihara is the technical term. They function like a Christian monastery. And these were large complexes in which the ascetics were supported by the pious donations of believers. We have some remarkable examples of the type of pious donations that could be given. These include, for instance, our earliest rock-cut monasteries in India at Ajanta, which are beautifully decorated with murals, probably donations by wealthy merchants in thanks for their prosperity and the karma they achieved by just conducting their daily life. Others were found in the so-called Mogal Caves in the vicinity of Dongguan. These were excavated by Sir Oral Stein. And again, they show spectacular fresco paintings of donors, of wealthy merchants, Sogdians, Tokarians, Chinese, all engaged in this activity in which Buddhism was part and parcel of their lives. It was from these contacts along the Silk Road that Buddhist missionaries arrived in China and began to translate various texts into Chinese to make them available to a Chinese audience. And this is already happening in the 2nd century AD and probably earlier. We have a number of names. We don't know much about them. These translations were out of perhaps Sanskrit originals or Sogdian and Tokarian originals. But what is clear is that by the 3rd century AD, there are a number of texts, Buddhist texts, sutras, now available. And these come from the different Buddhist schools, not just the greater vehicle, but the lesser vehicle schools that were already penetrating into China. And as we will talk about the later Chinese dynasties, the foreign dynasties, just as the Kushans, tended to favor Buddhist texts. The most remarkable figure coming out of this Buddhist world created on the Silk Road is a Chinese pilgrim by the name of Chuangxiang, born in 602 and dying in 664. He traveled along the Silk Road in search of manuscripts, and he went on a long pilgrimage first to Central Asia. He actually studied at the monastery beneath the great Buddhas at Bamiyan, those two marvelous rock-cut figures that were blown up by the Taliban as a retaliation against their political opponents in Afghanistan and the crazy fighting going on there right now. And he then entered into northern India, and he ended up at Sarnath, the very place where the Buddha had taught. And he brought back to China all sorts of Sanskrit texts, and essentially was commissioned to do more accurate translations that became extremely important in the dissemination of Buddhism under the Tang and later the Sung empires. And he is representative of the whole process of turning what was a Indian, almost a spin-off from Hinduism, into a universal faith of East Asia that would have powerful appeal on the Silk Road and powerful appeal upon all of these peoples of the central and eastern nomadic steppes. And Buddhism, which still prevails on the eastern steppes, was the language, was the religion of choice in Central Asia, on the Central Asian steppes, in the Tarim Basin, deep into the Middle Ages. And only gradually was it displaced by Islam. Well, if Buddhism was the most successful, there were a number of other religions that were exchanged across the Silk Road. And again, they're not as spectacular, and we don't have the same examples that we have from our Chinese pilgrims, but these included, for instance, Zoroastrianism. That was the official religion of the Sassanid Shahs. We'll be talking